This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Doris Haddock passed away this week. She was better known as Granny D, and in her 90s walked across America to bring attention to the issue of campaign finance reform. Keep America Safe has been airing an ad questioning the loyalties of Justice Department lawyers who defended Guantanamo detainees. Even some conservative Republicans have called the attack shameful. The jobs bill is moving through Congress and may be shaping up to be another party line vote. And the Oscars were awarded this past weekend. Are there political messages in who won? It's Politics Day, and we'll talk about those topics with our regular guests, New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson and Iowa State University political science professor Stefan Schmidt. We'll also take your calls and emails. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa. First, this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. It's Politics Day, and our regular Wednesday commentators are with us again today. Stefan Schmidt, Iowa State University political science professor, joins us from our studios in Ames. Good morning, Stefan. Good
morning, Jonathan.
And New Hampshire-based analyst Arnie Arneson is on the line with us as well. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning, Jonathan.
So Doris Haddock passed away, and that name probably doesn't ring a bell with a lot of people until you use her more commonly known moniker of Granny D. Walking across the country for campaign finance reform, passed away at the age of 100. Stefan, Arnie, what if anything does her passing show us about where campaign finance reform is today?
Well, I know her for deep fried haddock, and which I love, you know, with some mashed potatoes. But I think Arnie has a different reason why Ms. Haddock was famous.
Well, you need to know, Jonathan, that I have known Granny for a very long time, and actually, I was her very first interview before she left for her walk across the country. And I want you to picture this. She's 89, and I am doing a morning drive time show in Nashua, New Hampshire. The show begins at 6 o'clock. I had scheduled her to do an interview at 6:30, which I assumed was going to be on the phone. I get to my radio studio at about 5:15 in the morning to open the station and get ready for the day, and who is sitting on the steps of my radio studio but Doris Haddock? And I'm looking at this little old lady with a hat with a feather in it, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, she's a nutcase. And I said, why are you here? And she said, my son told me that I have to start getting used to waking up early in the morning and walking and being prepared because during the heat of the day I'll not be capable of walking. So most of the walking I'm going to be doing is in the early morning and the late evening. And I went, you're walking, right? This is the walking across the country? So she said, yes. I bring her into my studio, this 89-year-old pixie woman, and within 15 minutes, Jonathan, not only do I know that she will walk across the country, there is no question in my mind, but that I know that she will draw a tremendous amount of attention. The sad thing about the attention she drew, which really was to sort of talk about the corrosiveness of money in politics, John McCain came to her side, Russ Feingold came to her side, and I think as she died at 100, how depressed she must have been to see the system had rotted even more, that the Supreme Court had just made a horrific decision that actually allowed the floodgates to open with money, but that she truly understood that in the end, democracy will not flourish with cash. It will be destroyed by that. And at some point, and I know you must hate me for this because I did it last week, but what you need to also know is two things. One of the things Doris had is you have to ask me about her girdle, and you're going to say her girdle. And the reason is this. She was this tiny little woman with a sort of a weak back, and she knew that in order to walk across the country, she needed to be able to stand upright. So she had a girdle that had bones in it, and the bones meant that she could stay upright as she walked. I gave her an award for Common Cause in Washington, D.C., and I insisted that she tell this group about her girdle, and she did. And I asked her if she would donate her girdle, and she said, why? I said, because I know a lot of politicians that don't have a spine either. I wanted this girdle to be awarded to them because they need it. But she was a breed that I pray we can find again, because nothing stopped her from fighting for justice and freedom. Nothing. And she excited a lot of people, but the problem is now the economy has us so distracted that we forgot what we value. And I think that that's probably my biggest regret, is that she dies in some ways a little more anonymously because we're all licking our wounds and not looking to how to tackle the future.
A reminder, we are taking your calls and emails, 866-780-9100, or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org, 866-780-9100, or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Stefan, your personal connection to Granny D might not be as much, but what is your take on the current state of campaign finance and how the life of an activist like Granny D might be viewed in light of what's going on now?
Well, Arnie said it all, which is that the reality is that politicians don't want to limit the amount of cash that flows to their campaigns, and that campaigns are getting more and more expensive. Governor's races are now in the tens of millions of dollars. Races, even for state legislatures, maybe not in New Hampshire, but other places, are costing more money. And we are... In the United States, we are a culture that is very different from the Europeans or the Canadians, which is sometimes where we compare ourselves. We're just very different. And the idea that you limit people's speech is, by depriving them of spending money to buy speech is repulsive to a lot of people. And so getting public funding for elections has been a very, very difficult call. And even when you do that, we are a country that produces more lawyers than any other country in the world. I think we produce more lawyers than all the countries in the world put together. And you have public financing of campaigns, that still doesn't mean that the money dries up, because they will invent ways of having all kinds of independent groups in quotation marks and all kinds of other forms of spending that indirectly feeds into the existing campaigns or into the discussion of issues that it's just been impossible to basically stop, the continuous growth of it. I once followed around some students who were campaigning for, and I can't remember if it was Senator Culver in Iowa. Our governor's father was a senator. And they could not mention his name, but they were going door to door, banging on the door, and they were part of an environmental group that strongly supported this candidate. And they could send 1,000 little messages and hints and handouts that compared, the two different candidates' voting records and so on. And it was perfectly okay. It didn't violate any campaign finance laws because they were not campaigning for a candidate. They were campaigning for a cleaner environment. This was years and years ago. So we have always had the problem that we don't run our campaigns the way the Europeans and others do. Our campaigns are incredibly long, incredibly expensive, for the same reason that Americans generally have not supported, and politicians certainly haven't supported, a national health care system the way other countries have. That's the same reason why campaign finance reform has been such a huge struggle. And, now the Supreme Court ruling, as Arnie said, gives another incentive, to have an additional and easier flow of money. But even if that ruling hadn't come down, the amount of money that flows to politicians' campaigns and special interest advertising is enormous. And we see some ads running right now that are not directly targeted at any candidate, but they are well-funded advertisements that have a political message. And maybe we'll talk about some of those a little later.
Jonathan, may I read one thing? Well, I'm sorry. In 2001, right after she had done her walk, I was teaching at a small college on the Massachusetts border, and I begged the president to bring her in to give the graduation speech, and he kept looking at me. He goes, "She's 91, Arnie, she's 91. And I said, "She'll clean the clock of everyone else you could possibly imagine to give the speech." And so what they did was they compromised. I mean, this is. I just want to let people know what the middle looks like. And so they invited three people to give the graduation speech just to make me happy. I just need to let you know that when Doris finished, the students were standing on their chairs. But I have one paragraph, because this was her only warning that she gave in her speech. I've had the speech with me all my life. And she said this: "Read, study, meditate, and think for yourself. Let your most serious education now commence, if it has not already done so. Refine and hold your values and pay the high price necessary to live those values. Decide what is important to you and hold your ground against all temptations and tortures. from the pink granite of your own values, build a fortress against the world's ethical compromises, or you will soon be among those dead of eye who stand next to you in elevators but who are not alive. Don't let them steal your life. This is the only warning you will receive.
Let's take a call. Craig from Cedar Rapids has a comment on this. Craig, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi. I proposed this at the platform, Republican Platform Committee and the county convention, and naturally it was voted down. And that is that the media would allow political candidates to campaign free of charge. The reason being is that the media has the tendency to flame the fires of controversy and constantly look for controversy. And so all the candidates do is battle back and forth instead of discussing the issues. And they just help to help cause a lot of our problems with political debate and not having the candidates face the issues.
Yeah, they make elections more expensive by kind of stoking the fire of controversy. Huh?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, though. Not only does the media do it, but here's my dream, okay? My dream is that every single campaign ad for running for Congress or Senate must be done by the candidate themselves. No subliminal messages, no puppy dogs, no blue sky, no none of that stuff. And not only does the candidate actually have to appear in their own campaign ad, oh my God, but the ad must last a minimum of 2 minutes. So instead of this incredible 15-second, 30-second soundbite that sounds good and says nothing, they have to deliver something in the way of content. They actually have to appear, my goodness, they actually have to appear in their own campaign ads. And then we might consider doing what I think the Brits do. And I think the Brits give every party like 10 or 15 minutes during the course of the evening during a campaign mode. And people know how well different parties are doing. This is a true story. That they can tell by whether the water pressure drops in the city of London.
The toilet's flushing.
Because the toilets are flushing, which means they're bored and they're getting
they're
up
bored,
the TV.
They're bored. People go.
Well,
yeah.
Even if a certain amount of time was allocated to candidates, would that really stop them from buying additional time, or would that just free up the millions of dollars that they have to now spend on something else?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it would. I mean, they would hire more canvassers instead of spending it on TV ads. They would set up more elaborate websites with even more attractive flash, you know, presentations and campaign contribution, donation possibilities. They would be able to do all kinds of. They would be able to travel more. They wouldn't have to spend it on television ads. They could use it more for their private jets to fly around and meet with groups. So. It's a problem.
Thanks to Craig for your call. Coming up after the break, we will talk about a web ad, speaking of political ads, that took a shot at the Department of Justice. Even though it did so, a lot of conservatives are calling it shameful. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are our guests for Politics Wednesday here on the program. We're also taking your phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, the group Keep America Safe ran a web ad that called into question the loyalty of some Department of Justice attorneys. And I know that Stefan and Arnie would both like to talk about this. Before we do, let's hear the ad. And it's difficult to know everything because you don't see the visual imagery that goes along with this. But we're going to play the audio from that ad. So here it comes.
The pendulum is starting to swing. An America run by progressives is really, it's about to happen. We're going to be looking for people who share our values.
So who did President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder hire? 9 lawyers who represented or advocated for terrorist detainees. Who are these government officials? Eric Holder will only name 2. Why the secrecy behind the other 7? Whose values did they share? Tell Eric Holder, Americans have a right to know the identity of the Al-Qaeda 7.
It's important to note that the visual that went along with while the voiceover said that whose values do they share? Osama bin Laden was the image that was up during that point of the commercial. Many conservatives, including Ken Starr, have come out and called the commercial shameful. Liz Cheney, who helps run the group Keep America Safe, along with Bill Kristol, said that the ad, in her words, doesn't question anyone's loyalty. Steph and Arnie, what do you make of this? And did this work? Is this important?
Well, you know, I as soon as I saw the ad, what you need to know, Jonathan, is I went back and looked up Lady Justice. And I want to send the concept of Lady Justice to Liz Cheney, because she forgets about Lady Justice and exactly who she is, because she's always depicted with a set of scales, you know, suspended from one hand, which basically means she's looking for balance. It's a double-edged sword in her right hand, basically symbolizing reason and power. And also, she is blind, because she's supposed to be impartial, and she's supposed to act without fear or favor. And I'm thinking of this, and I'm thinking, what is she doing? Think of all the lawyers in every firm who go to law school. You don't go to pick a side. You go to make sure that justice happens. And this is going to come back to bite her in the proverbial butt. Not only have a lot of conservatives and libertarians really come down hard on Liz Cheney, but you know what Liz Cheney forgot to look at? She forgot to look at some of her important players. For example, the Bush administration. For example, Rudy Giuliani. Because it turns out that Rudy Giuliani and the Bush administration actually brought into either their law firm or their administration lawyers that represented people at Gitmo. And the reason is that it's about justice. And that is our value, not picking a side and assuming that your side is always right. Because that's not what justice is about. And it is so scary, because when she kept talking about values, she was actually walking away from America's values. You know, this is the land of opportunity. This is about freedom. This is about justice. And what she's talking about, frankly, are things that we used to fight, you know, in the USSR, and what we fear about China, and what we fear about, frankly, Osama bin Laden. So it's pretty scary stuff.
Stefan, what's your take?
Yeah, well, I don't think it has much to do with substance. I think it's, you know, sort of an ideological hand grenade that Cheney has thrown into the discussion here. A lot of these things are not meant to be based on any kind of real concerns or facts, but simply on the effort to try and polarize people, to raise doubts about, in this case, the Obama administration Justice Department. And, you know, with a lot of people, that'll resonate. You know, and on the other hand, with a lot of other people, it's gotten them absolutely furious, and including, as you said, the you know, a group of lawyers. Let me read you a one little paragraph here. A group of lawyers who served previously under Republican presidents issued a public denunciation of Ms. Cheney's tactics, calling them unjust, destructive, and shameful. And it was signed by Ken Starr and former Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, and so on. And so Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa continues his drive to ferret out terrorist-hugging lawyers in the Obama administration. And this is from a column by Bob Barr called The Barr Code, which is a column that he writes. So Iowa has a little bit of a tie-in, too, because apparently Senator Grassley also wants the names. Now, the other question I have, and I haven't been able to find anything on this, is why doesn't the Attorney General just release the names? I mean, are they secret names, or is there something wrong with the names? Or, you know, I don't understand. If you have it's the same like the climate change controversy. Why don't they just release the model with which they concluded that there is all this climate change in the world, and then there wouldn't be so much, aha, you see, this is secret, and nobody's telling. So I think that also hasn't helped much.
So if Eric Holder just released the names or gave an explanation on why he can't, he can diffuse the controversy?
Well, yeah. I mean, the controversy is there now, but I think he can essentially have something to counteract this accusation, whereas if he keeps the name secret for whatever reasons he has to, there are tens of millions of people who believe that the space aliens, you know, come regularly to Earth to do things. And there will be tens of millions of people who believe that because this is secret, there is something that's being hidden, you know. And so fresh air and Clorox are always the best way to sort of clean up things.
Let's go to the phones. Amos from Des Moines is on the line. Amos, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hey, listen, I listen to your show every day. And I finally got a chance to speak and talk on it. First of all, I want to say you got a terrific show. And next thing I want to say, our college is not doing a very good job for educating our people about our government. Mm-hmm. I went to a private school in South Dakota, Mount Marty, and I am so glad I went there because, you know what, I'm looking at people today calling our president a socialist. But do you know India is the oldest democracy in the world, and their former government is socialist.
That's right.
And I'm sitting here looking at such an educated society. That's the 1 billion people that we're attacking.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, I went to school, I made a choice. There was a guy that committed suicide at Creighton University. He was a basketball player, and I looked at him and I saw myself. And I turned down major schools and went to the private school, and I'm so glad because, you know what, I work for myself. And 30 years ago, my professor told me, he said, you're never going to be free in America till you're economically free.
Mm.
And he talked about capitalism. And he told me capitalism will be the downfall of America if it's not practiced right. And if you look at the healthcare industry today, how they are capitalizing on the poor, we can find $40 billion to give Afghanistan, but here the schools are falling apart. We can't even find $1 billion to get them over. Something
mm-hmm.
is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to engage the college students and the young people, everybody.
Well, you
That's
know,
all I really want.
And I appreciate your call because I teach some semesters. It's approximately 300 or 400 of them in one semester at Iowa State. And I have a very difficult time getting my message through because they're getting educated by all kinds of talk radio people who are on the air 3 to 6 hours a day, and they're listening to them. They get educated by political stuff on the internet that I have no control over, and a lot of which is crazy stuff. I mean, my American government textbook is where we try to tell the way things really are, and they're getting too much information that is unreliable, but more fun, more interesting, more exciting than what I can deliver them. And this is a real big problem because they leave my classroom and they still don't believe what I'm trying to teach them because they're getting the opposite point of view from so many other sources.
Well, caller, you make an amazing point, but think about this. Like your professor who talked to you about capitalism and how if you had that economic independence, you would be free, but that there was a problem with capitalism. There's a problem with anything to excess, anything. Too much water, too much fat, too much anything to excess becomes problematic, and that's even true of capitalism. The reason I say that is that capitalism thrives with some kind of checks and balances. Democracy thrives with some kind of checks and balances. And that's really the measure of whether we really understand what our values are. That's why I was so upset about Liz Cheney, because she forgot about what justice was. It was those scales. It was those checks and balances. Instead, she pointed the finger of guilt. And that obviously doesn't understand or comprehend that.
Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about the jobs bill going through Congress, the green jobs element to that. We're also going to talk about the Academy Awards. Yes, there may be a political tie-in. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul, Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, and Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst, are out with us, as they are each week for Politics Wednesday on the program. We're taking your calls and emails as well, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about jobs, because there's a jobs bill that's in Congress. There's a threatened jobs bill in the Iowa legislature as well. There's a lot of talk on green jobs and what that might do. The economy, if it's getting better, it's at a very slow pace. Stefan and Arnie, what impact do you think the government getting in the business of trying to create jobs will have in the coming months?
Well, I'll start because I was listening to a conversation the other day on the radio, and it was on public radio, so it's okay, Stefan. I don't think I was being sort of directed in the wrong way. But one of the things this guy was saying is that so many people now are unemployed, Jonathan, not for a couple of months, but for 6 months, 9 months, a year. And this is devastating for families, but it's also devastating to the economy in this way. They are losing skills. That as we are moving forward around the world, they are getting stale and old and dry and forgetting really what it is that they need to do to be in the workforce. And that government has an obligation in some ways not just to do make work, but to ensure these people are on sort of a stable track so they can then flip to the job, so they can then improve their skills. So when the economy comes, as I'm hoping, roaring back, they will be ready. So there is a lot of reasons why the government can get involved in jobs, and it isn't just about basically blowing cash, but it really is about making those necessary investments because those jobs create other opportunities. And I go back to what I said before. Infrastructure, we have a huge, enormous need, not just to repair the infrastructure, but to envision new infrastructure. And for every dollar, the public dollar that we spend, whether it's an Iowa dollar, a New Hampshire dollar, or a federal dollar, you end up stimulating about $6 or $7 in the private marketplace. And even if those jobs are temporary, give me a job for a year. I'm fine. I've been unemployed for a year. I'll take temporary because if temporary gets me to the job I can have for the next year, 2, 5 years, then so be it. Let that happen. But I think we are both wasting money, wasting opportunity, and more important, we are wasting lives.
Sounds like you're advocating the opposite of the WPA, just jobs for job's sake.
No, it isn't just jobs for job's sake. And frankly, the article I sent you, there was a group of folks that were looking at green jobs. And green jobs are so amazing because what they really do is that they're not just about job creation. They are about security, economic independence, saving money. Because when you're realizing that you're creating a job in this country that actually produces energy, you are no longer dependent on mining. You are no longer dependent on Saudi Arabia and oil. There was a wonderful statement that said, this war that we're fighting on terrorism, this was said by, I think, a commander, the war we're fighting on terrorism is ironic because we are funding both sides. How are we funding both sides? Because we are going to Saudi Arabia to basically buy our oil. The Saudis then send billions of dollars to the Wahhabis. The Wahhabis are teaching their youth about the jihad. And then what do? We then use that oil in our SUVs, and we start the vicious cycle again. So these things are so complicated, but you don't make a mistake when you create a job. I'm sorry, you don't.
Stefan?
The Wall Street Journal today has an interesting article called Unemployment Rates by State, and it has the Bureau of Labor Statistics January seasonally adjusted. And the second part of the headline is most regions add jobs in January. And so you have 30 states and the District of Columbia where unemployment continued to rise a little bit in January from the month earlier. But you had 31 states in which jobs were added, so that there is some indication that, you know, there is a recovery. And the other thing is it's a very regional, spotty, and not uniform situation across the country. We know that. We know that unemployment rate in some parts of the country in Michigan are extremely high. In other parts of the country, you have industries that are much more resistant to even a recession that's as widespread as this. So the other thing I wanted to add was that in the end, you can create jobs with tax money, but the purpose of creating those, as Arnie kind of implied, is to get the economy going again, and then the government basically has to sort of step back and start recovering from the growth in the private sector, because, you know, the economy, if the government is creating all the jobs, it tends to not be market forces that are driving those jobs. It tends to be other forces. And so it's not supply and demand. It's not consumer necessity or replacement and stuff. So it is the private sector. And in the private sector, there is now a real serious problem. And I can report this from Business Week, which I think in the article that I read in last week's Bloomberg Business Week, is that companies that have slashed jobs and are continuing to cut jobs, and it includes universities, by the way, for those of you who are listening, because we're doing that in higher education. There is now an indication that they are making a serious mistake, because when a recovery begins, they are going to find themselves with a diminished workforce in which they can't then jump onto the recovery. And it creates a serious institutional hiccup. In universities, for example, when you start doing this, what happens is the best people who are in great demand and have job offers all the time simply give up on places that are not, that are cutting jobs, and they'll leave and they'll go away, and you end up with people who are frozen in place. And so the loss of jobs or the reduction in the workforce also has a real serious productivity, long-term productivity side effect. So it's not good for companies either, in addition to not being good, obviously, for people who are unemployed. But it's just not good for companies, because you lose institutional memory, you lose a senior workforce, which companies love to fire senior people because they make more money and their healthcare costs are higher. Those are the people who understand where all the skeletons are, where all the glitches are, and who can make a company successful. When you have a fresh, young, and cheap workforce, you are not going to be able to compete as well.
So how does the government then, or should the government be involved in this job creation? And then how do they do it to address some of the concerns that you're mentioning, Stefan?
Well, I think you work very closely with the private sector. This is a country where the prosperity of the economy is driven by the private sector. And you make sure that you are targeting essentially stimulus money so that it does actually create jobs that then produce not just, you know, some sort of temporary employment situation, but that retrain a workforce for companies and industries that are simply on hold, or that have pushed a reset button and will jumpstart again as the world economy recovers. And I'm not sure that we've done that, because a lot of the information about recovery money is that it's been kind of haphazardly sort of thrown at all kinds of things, in some cases at infrastructure projects that are worthless, that are not going to contribute to any kind of long-term economic benefits, you know, airports or paving roads that lead to nowhere just to create jobs. And I think that is a very expensive and in the long term an unfortunate way of doing it.
But stop it, Stefan. Can I tell you something? When you talk about the road to nowhere, the bridge to nowhere, and of course all of Alaska comes into my head, most of the infrastructure that we are talking about is essential. How many bridges do we know that are redlined right now, that are dangerous, that have not been repaired, because states have been triaging which they do first, and they have to see the bricks falling off the bridge before they actually go to repair the bridge? Ask people in Minnesota about bridges. That was not a bridge to nowhere. That was the bridge in the middle of St. Paul, Minneapolis. I mean, this is part of the problem, is that you can't suggest that. And more importantly, there are a lot of people right now that are collecting unemployment, and we're constantly extending unemployment benefits. Is there a win-win strategy where we can invest those unemployment benefits in putting people into certain kinds of jobs? Because right now I know a lot of people are very risk averse about bringing new employees on, because they're not quite sure how the economy is going. And there is a huge investment to train a new worker when you bring them into a small business setting or a large business setting. What if we brought some people who are collecting their unemployment benefits, let them continue to collect it, but be in the workplace? One, they could strut their stuff. Two, they could learn on the job. Three, they would be there when the economy comes back. We have to be creative, but it takes government to be creative, because I hate to break it to you, but all the tax incentives for small business to bring on a new employee ain't enough, because they're looking at the risk and they're looking at the few bucks they're going to be getting from that tax credit, and they're saying it ain't worth it. So you know what? Let's be a little more exotic. Let's make a bigger leap and let's really sort of move the economy forward. And that's something I don't see us doing or being somewhat reluctant and fearful to do. You know, how low do you have to go before you're willing to run a risk?
We've got a couple of callers I'd like to get in here. Dwayne from Marshalltown is on the line. Dwayne, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you for having me on. I was going to comment on, I think there's a big change taking place in our economy, and that we're going to, solar energy and that type of thing is going to take over. My analogy is I'm from back in the 1930s, and I remember in my family, everybody complained about my grandfather because he lost all his money in horses. Mm. My dad drove a bread truck, and that's an analogy of today. At that time, I suspicion my grandfather invested in horses. At the time, the car was coming in and then lost his shirt, and the people investing in GM is going to have the same thing happening now. My dad drove a bread truck. The guys that opened the bakery back then, father had a bakery down by the city hall, and they bought an industrial one, and that changed the economy. And what's happening now, everything that we have in the petroleum business is going to go out. It should have been going out for a long time. Right. But you see, the Tesla's got their cars coming in. That's where the new market is. The BYD has got new cars coming in. Obama has put out a lot of money and grants to solar and wind and things like that. They're going to hire people out of college in the next 4 or 5 years. But if you are in the automobile business and you are old, the same thing's going to happen to my grandfather. You're going to have to live on your laurels of the past, and the new generation will take over, and it'll all be solar and digital. And I'm 75 right now, and everything I own I see is totally obsolete within the next 5 years.
Well, it's interesting. Can I make a really quick comment? Last night I had to call my neighbor so that he would bring his huge, enormous John Deere tractor over and pull a guy out of the ditch who had managed to go down my road at night and buried himself. And my neighbor is a very innovative farmer and is always on the cutting edge. And you'll find his name in the New York Times frequently because he really is a very early adopter. And we were talking just in his nice heated cab while we were pulling this guy out. And he's working right now on something that is not petroleum from Saudi Arabia or other oil products, but it is still a product that will drive vehicles that look very similar to what we have, and those are biofuels, you know, all kinds of fuels that are actually produced through fermentation processes and in other ways. So I have a feeling that we will actually have a real mix, as you said, of new technologies. But I think some of it is going to be stuff that you pull into a gas station, you know, by the interstate, and you pour it in, only it doesn't come from dead dinosaurs. It comes from various facilities that are preparing and cooking every day biomass and creating liquid fuels and other fuels for us. We'll have a mix of things.
And caller, you're absolutely right. We have to anticipate the direction that we're going, and we're not going to always pick it right. We're not. I'm looking at a press release from January 31st, 2010, okay? What is the Coca-Cola company unveiling today? A new plastic bottle made partially from plants, okay? They call it the plant bottle. So we knew that most of the plastics in this country come from petroleum products, okay? That's another reason why we've so embraced oil. Well, it turns out that they are now looking at the opportunity of creating a totally recyclable, totally biodegradable, totally plant-based plastic that may be as competitive as anything we could produce from oil, and in the long run, even more competitive. We have to get out of the rut, and part of the reason why government is going to help is that they can start at least laying a foundation for some of these investments. And you know what? Government will make mistakes. Can I tell you that, everyone? Government will make mistakes, but guess what? Your grandfather made a mistake with horses. Welcome to the world of mistakes. But sometimes we also make the right choices.
We have a little bit of time left on the show, and an intriguing topic that I wanted to bring up. And Stefan, I know you'd like to talk about this. The Academy Awards were announced on Sunday night, and lots of people attended Oscar parties and may have even had some wagers of sorts on betting on who would win what. Is there a political message that may have arisen from who won this year?
Well, there were three things that I've talked about this with friends. One of them was, of course, Hurt Locker and Kathryn Bigelow getting Best Movie and Producer Award, first woman ever, and so on. So there was definitely a message, a gender message, going out in that direction. Avatar had a slightly different problem. Let's call it a problem, because are a lot of veterans and a lot of people in the U.S. military who really didn't like the way the armed services were depicted in that movie, and found it to be a very clear political message, you know, about war and killing civilians and blowing up giant trees where people live. And so there is that movie, though it's a fantastic movie in every other respect, does have a very complicated political message in it, with parallels to the current, you know, situation, parallels in countries where there are indigenous people who have land where oil companies are going to exploit oil. They certainly saw the message, you know, in Avatar, which was about defiling, you know, natural habitats in the interest of corporations. And the whole message, the anti-corporate message that was in Avatar, was so obvious that it hit you on the head with a 2x4, unless you'd had too much, popcorn.
Now that they're going to control everything because of Citizens United, God forbid the corporations are now going to control the Oscars.
Right. This is
Oh my God.
Then the other message was, of course, or the other political undercurrent or theme was Monique and the movie Precious, and you know, the reminder that African Americans still have somewhat of a struggle, and you know, the remembrance of the pioneer African American woman who got the first Academy Award. And that one was, I think, thematically part of a dialogue that is still going on in this country, that we heard in an earlier program about the census and minorities, and a topic that we still find somewhat difficult, and some people would like to just dispel that, you know, there's still considerations that have to do with ethnicity and race in this country that affect public policy, politics, and justice, and other things. So there were plenty of political themes that you could pick up and go for weeks discussing.
Well, and do you think those themes that come out of that kind of venue strike a stronger chord with the average American than a congressional subcommittee meeting on such and such?
You got it right on the head. You know, there are not that many policy wonks in this country, but when you raise complicated issues in theater, music, and entertainment, plays, and so on, you've got to remember that the whole history of popular culture is a history of essentially trying to critique leaders and tyrants and others in such a way that they wouldn't come and cut your head off. You know, and in dictatorships, the only way you can still do that or can do it is by writing sort of fictional stories about fairies and other things in which everybody can see who is the bad dictator without you actually saying it. So I think popular culture is highly underestimated by most people as a powerful political force in this country. And I think it's a shame, for example, that newspapers in the United States no longer really run a front page powerful cartoon. The Des Moines Register dropped their cartoonist because for a lot of people who don't want to read the story about what's going on in the Iowa legislature or with Governor Culver, a really powerful cartoon every morning would be their little political snack or their little coffee cup in the morning on politics. And one of the great American cartoonists just went to a cartoonist's convention in Colombia, in Bogota, Colombia, and he was shocked because there were hundreds and hundreds of well-paid and brilliant political cartoonists working for all the different newspapers in Colombia and also other Latin American countries, who were there and talking and exchanging ideas. And then in the United States, you know, newspapers have been slashing away political cartoonists to cut costs. And yet, as a graphic way of telling a story, it is probably the most powerful thing that's ever come along. So
actually, it's so amazing that you're saying this. I used to give speeches, and I would describe a cartoon as my way of beginning a speech, and this was when I was talking about the war in Iraq, and it was a cartoon, three frames, Jonathan. The first frame is a bald eagle, you know, draped in all this sort of American armor, and what you do is you see this amazing sort of military bald eagle suddenly go from that and it morphs in the three frames. And what is the last frame? It is now a sitting duck. I will never forget it. That's like 7-9 years ago. I won't forget it.
Yeah.
I mean, it told a story more powerful than anything anybody would read. And again, I think you're absolutely right about popular culture. And the funny thing is, as we were watching The Hurt Locker get Best Director, and it's the first woman to get Best Director, I'm sitting on the bed with my 89-year-old aunt, who was one of the first women CEOs in America, and she's looking at the TV and her eyes are turning into slits. And I said, "What's wrong, Jeannie?" She said, "Did she get it because she was female, or did she deserve it?"
Ooh, wow.
And this is my 89-year-old aunt. And I said, "Here's the good news, Joanna. She deserved it because she took every risk. She took every risk. Risk with actors, risk with topic, risk with money." I said, "Think about it." I said, "It wasn't a big screen, 10-year, multi-gazillion-dollar production. It was a topic that most people would have run away from, and she didn't. She went after it." I said, "She deserves it because of topic, let alone anything else."
On the topic of cartoons, I do have to confess that everything that I know about Watergate, I learned from Doonesbury books that I discovered in the back of my parents' bookshelf when I was in high school.
Yeah.
That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa this
you.
Week. Those topics and more next week with Arnie Arneson and Stefan Schmidt. Arnie, Stefan, thanks for joining us as always.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Our program is produced by Dennis Reese with assistance from Julie Englander. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. You can make a comment anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Send us an email. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.